Robert Fivelant is an entertainment lawyer and a film producer. And a few years ago, he heard about this stash of videotape in the basement of a man named Hal Tulchin. In the summer of 1969, Tulchin had been hired to film the Harlem Cultural Festival. And he had 40 hours of coverage that basically no one wanted. Which is crazy because this was an amazing moment in music and cultural history. You had people in the streets protesting the war, protesting poverty and racism. Remember, this was the summer of Woodstock, which you've already heard plenty about, but in Harlem, you had musicians like Stevie Wonder and Sly Stone and Gladys Knight and Nina Simone playing for tens of thousands of people who were on the edge, like the rest of the country, and using music as this outlet and expression of defiance. And Hal had the tape, but no one wanted it. So it sat there in his basement.
When Hal shot this on spec in 1969, he was smart enough to realize the importance of these artists and knew that this was something that was important to capture just from an historical perspective. He was frustrated that other people didn't see it that way, right? And so I do think there was a long period of time where he just said, you know, I'm just going to hang on to it. He lived in a nice house in Bronxville, New York. I did walk down there and, you know, I visited him many times and he was a shrewd guy. And so, you know, he was, you know, concerned that it got done the right way. So the canisters, they were enormous. You know, we originally rescued them from his basement, you know, from that perspective. And we set about trying to restore them. They hadn't really been gone through in quite some time, and given that they were shot on 2-inch tape, there were restoration issues, part of which was that there's only so many people that still had machines that could even process those tapes. That was part of the challenge of making the movie, for sure.
Robert Fivelant thought there was a film in there, so he got the producer David Dinnerstein involved.
If you can imagine what you think is a traditional film canister, it's roughly half of that. Each particular reel is very heavy. As Robert said, you know, it's physically 2 inches of videotape. And Hal was, you know, really ahead of his time when he decided that that was the medium he wanted to use to shoot these concerts. He, you know, assembled 5 cameras, position them in various parts of the audience and on the stage, and was able to really direct his entire team at that point. And I think what sets, you know, the footage from the Harlem Cultural Festival apart from many other concert films is Hal really used his eye well, but he also cared about what the audience was doing at the time. And one of the cameras was actually devoted to watching the audience. So, you know, if you watch our film, you can really capture the faces and the sort of mood, the energy of the audience. We feel that it really helped immerse you into being at this particular show.
It's one of the best things about the film in some ways is seeing those faces, seeing that sea of faces, people dancing, people responding to those moments. And that's what makes it so great. We're not just looking at performers, though that's great, but we're seeing the people because that's kind of what it's about in some ways.
I think it's a testament to how important the music has become to our culture. I've joked about seeing the kid in the sombrero dancing to Stevie Wonder and the little girl dancing to Herbie Mann. Like, you watch old footage of like people dancing in the 40s and 50s and it seems dated. Those kids still have great moves like today.
Yeah.
I would also say that yes, the film is a powerful story about a music, but it's also, you know, a social and cultural history of people set in really its most famed a neighborhood. We really felt a responsibility and an obligation to sort of shine a light on what Harlem was like 52 years ago. And we really wanted to capture the essence, the heartbeat of that.
So they had the film. Now they needed a director. And they had just the person in mind, the musician and music historian Amir Thompson, Questlove of the band The Roots. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. We're talking about the story of the Harlem Cultural Festival in 1969. The film is called Summer of Soul. Our guests for the hour are Robert Fivelant and David Dinnerstein, who told us that when Questlove first saw the footage of the festival, he couldn't believe he hadn't heard about it before. And Questlove has said he wasn't quite sure he wanted the responsibility. Here's Robert Fivelant.
It's a lot of pressure taking on the role of a first-time director, much less
right.
the role of a first-time director of an historical, important piece of, you know, filmmaking. So, I think anybody would have felt that way.
Yeah, I think Amir, you know, was doubting himself at the very beginning, saying, am I up, you know, to actually directing something as critical and as important as this? And I think, you know, he quickly realized that, you know, this was such a unique project and that he would be capable of telling the story. And he embraced that in such a huge way and, you know, was so critical in obviously not only directing the movie, but really shaping every aspect of it. So he's such, you know, a talented filmmaker, in addition to being a talented artist and novelist, et cetera.
A music historian. I mean, yeah. I don't think anybody knows as much as he does about this music, and that was important for us.
So let's talk about how the project changed from maybe the initial idea. Amir Thompson has talked about how at first he thought about, you know, curating it like a concert film to some degree. But then it seems like you all were starting to see this moment happening and seeing these parallels, and it became something more than that. Talk about how the film evolved.
I think we all at one point said this footage is so amazing, it would be a concert film. And, you know, we talked about what music needed to be in the film. But the film captures something that's much more important than just the musical performances. And I think there was that moment, but I would also say that, you know, there was, it became clear pretty quickly that this was going to be something, you know, where we didn't just strictly show the footage like an Amazing Grace. You know, we really felt that there was context and other things we wanted to include. So.
I would also say that, you know, once we started going down the rabbit hole in respect to the research we were doing on the film, once we started the outreach to finding people who attended the festival, trying to get in touch with some of the performers that are still with us, you know, we really discovered, you know, a few things. You know, one is that this was a historic event that was forgotten, literally forgotten, and almost lost to history. And, you know, one of the themes that came up was that it's all too common for people of color, that there is this theme of the erasure of American history, but specifically Black history. And we wanted to, Amir wanted to really reclaim that. And he felt sort of the burden of responsibility of making that, you know, a theme in our story. So it started as, wow, the music is amazing. But once we started getting into things and once we looked at, you know, the 40 hours of footage, we realized that it's not just, you know, phenomenal Black performers, you know, in their prime, but it's Latinx performers, you know, it is people from all sort of walks of the earth. We had international performers like Hugh Masekela or Baba Olatunje or Mongo Santa Maria, you know, and we wanted, and these are all people who were in and around the Harlem community at the time. Hugh Masekela lived in Harlem. He, you know, came to the United States with the support of
Harry Belafonte.
Of Harry Belafonte at the time. And he went to music school and he was in the community. So this was all about that. And I think, you know, that's when the film, you know, felt like we have an obligation to tell a much bigger story than simply just a concert that took place.
I would also say there was, you know, it could have gone the wrong way too, where it just became, you know, a shortcut of a song and then, you know, interviews. And we really felt the music needed to breathe. And we had long conversations about finding places where we could, you know, literally have, you know, large portions of the sections, you know, play in the movie. And so there is an element of it being, you know, you get some of the feeling of a concert movie as well. And that was important.
Yeah. So I think the parallels people are going to notice right away between 1969 and 2000, you know, 18, 19, 2020. Talk a little bit about that context, 1969. As people say in the film, Black America had lost faith in the country. They're seeing a lot of people being jailed and killed. You know, we're talking about the wake of the assassination of John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy, and of course, Dr. King and Malcolm X. Talk a little bit about the setting for what was going on in 1969 for this festival.
Well, in years leading up to the festival, there were three very tragic events that, adversely impacted, the Black community at the time. You know, one was the assassination of Malcolm X. One was the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And one was the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Obviously, there were many more things that were critical as well. And during that time, there was obviously a lot of political unrest. Our country was at war in Vietnam. As we tell in our story, you know, a majority of people who served were people of color at the time. Yeah. The community was having a very challenging time in general. After, you know, the assassination of Dr. King, there were riots throughout the country. You had two diverging tracks at the time. One was the non-violent track, and one was let's take the bull by the horns and try and make a change. And, you know, it's incredible because I think when you look back over the past year, compared to 50 years ago, you know, despite this film taking place 50 years ago, it's incredibly topical. You know, unfortunately, we as a country seem to be dealing with many of the same social, civil, and political issues today as we experienced 50 plus years ago.
Yeah, I also think that there's a tie into your last question. You know, when we started looking at the footage and realized that, you know, we wanted to do more than a concert film, we started thinking about, well, how are we going to structure this into a story? And the most immediate story that sort of came to the fore was the idea that it had to have been an incredible thing to have accomplished this festival, and how could that have happened in that community? And that led us to really the understanding that, you know, each, you know, there were multiple parties that had different motivations for this. I mean, for Mayor Lindsay in the city, it was to you know, forge bonds with that community. For some of the artists, it was to make their own statement about where the country was. For Tony Lawrence, it was putting that all together and making a name for himself. So, you know, all of those things I think come out in the movie. And, you know, we made a conscious decision not to make obvious, you know, not to draw parallels to today's events, only because we think it's more powerful when the audience sees that for themselves.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, just going back to the time, you know, in 1969, Harlem was so feared by people outside of the community that when the festival, you know, took place and the city sanctioned and supported the festival, the New York Police Department
rarely entered the concert area, you know. And that's primarily because the community didn't trust them. So the Black Panthers were hired to run a security, really to keep the police in check to some extent. And I have to say, you know, this took place over 6 days. It was the most passive, you know, fun, community-based, family-attending festival that I've seen perhaps ever. You know, it was really...
Someone called it a total party atmosphere.
Yeah.
But I think in an important way, it does address stereotypes, right? Because if you think about what people thought about Harlem, of it being a dangerous place and all of that, we've joked about the fact that, you know, when you watch Woodstock, they announce, you know, watch out for the brown acid. At the beginning of our movie, if you're paying attention, they announce Ann Reynolds has lost her wallet. You know, you know, and that alone sort of sums up, you know, the difference in many ways, right?
Robert Fivelent, along with David Dinnerstein, they're producers of the film Summer of Soul, or The Revolution Could Not Be Televised. It's in the U.S. documentary competition at this year's festival. It was directed by Amir Questlove Thompson. You can get information about the festival on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
The Utah legislative session is always 45 days long, and this year's session is shaping up to be extra weird due to the pandemic. I'm Sonia Hudson, politics reporter at KUER.
And I'm Emily Means, another politics reporter at KUER. We're the hosts of the podcast 45 Days, guiding you through the most important political issues of the week.
Subscribe to 45 Days for free wherever you get your podcasts, or just go to 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about one of the opening night films at Sundance this year. It's called Summer of Soul, directed by the musician and historian Questlove. It's about the Harlem Cultural Festival in the summer of 1969, where musicians like Stevie Wonder and Nina Simone and Max Roach and B.B. King and Sly and the Family Stone all performed in midst of social and racial unrest throughout the country. Now, the festival was filmed, but all of the tape, it stayed in a basement for like 50 years. We have with us the film's producers, Robert Fivelent and David Dinnerstein. That's who you'll hear next. I wanted to ask you about how you decided to structure the film, because almost all of the musical numbers that we see are kind of like these mini documentaries, which say something about the African-American experience in the country at the time. So we see a performance, but also the story behind it. And each is kind of like a moment in time and a portrait of the artist and how they're thinking about their art and kind of a representation of change. Talk about how you were thinking about putting this all together.
I mean, I'll jump in and say Amir has a certain way of telling stories, whether it is how he puts together, you know, songs with the roots for an album, or how he curates a DJ set. You know, he likes to sort of, you know, like a film, have three acts, but those acts need sort of a banger. You know, they need, you know, specific performances or scenes that really capture your interest in a huge way. So he came up with the idea of, wow, I want to do a cold open and I want to start with a performance from Stevie Wonder that most people have never, ever seen before. So, you know, to see Stevie play drums is sort of an amazing way to start the film. We think he was really smart because it draws everyone in immediately. And then, you know, he had some other big moments in the film. You know, we think towards the end with Nina and you know, the performance she had is a highlight of the film. And obviously in the middle of the film, the duet, if you will, between Mahalia Jackson and Mavis Staples is to me, you know, one of the greatest parts of this film.
Yeah, I want to let's get there. I want to start with the sort of the segue into gospel music in the film. So Marilyn McCoo from Fifth Dimension, they perform, and she talks about wanted, as she says in the film, we wanted our people to know what we were about. We wanted them to receive us. She gets really emotional, and the role of gospel music in the festival comes into play, and the way the film explores it as an element of Black culture. I mean, we see Jesse Jackson leading people in prayer, and the critic and writer Greg Tate says in the film that there is something specific in Black America where the only place they could be fully expressive was in their music and in those church rituals. And in that sense, gospel music was really important there. Talk a little bit about gospel music and the role that it plays in this festival and in the story here.
Well, I think, you know, as David mentioned a few minutes ago, there were, you know, as civil unrest was, you know, happening across the country, you know, there were different camps. There was a violent, you know, a crowd that thought, again, that change should be immediate, and others that were in favor of you know, a more peaceful transition. And I think gospel was, you know, and the church was a place where, you know, you can see where that fell into one of those two camps. And it's interesting that the film captures a moment in time when that, you know, that gospel started to the influence of gospel started to impact music that was reaching a broader audience. And, you know, there's a whole segment in the film where we interview a member of the Edwin Hawkins Singers who talks about how the church actually, you know, persecuted them for trying to go outside the church.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think it's such a spiritual music. And I think, you know, part of the story is gospel, you know, was a way for a release as well, for the tension, for the buildup, for people to sort of, you know, literally, as a Marilyn said, take it to church. They understood the impact and the spirituality that was there. And I think it lent itself to not only the gospel artists, but other artists in the documentary as well. Someone like Sonny Chirac, who's an avant-garde jazz guitarist, you know, had a solo in the film that, you know, some people may find to be atonal. It could be completely crazy, but, you know, the understanding was that was something coming out of his energy because he, you know, it was a way of saying, hey, world, this is how we deal with our own issues. Reverend Al Sharpton in the film talks about it's a release for African Americans who, you know, unlike others in the country, may not be able to afford a therapist to get the release that they have. And music and gospel specifically, you know, has that ability. And I think, you know, the specific scene with Mahalia and Mavis, where Mahalia, who at that time was the queen of gospel, was literally handing the microphone or handing the torch, if you will, or passing the torch to a younger Mahalia, a younger Mavis Staples, was such a beautiful moment. And to just listen to them sing together, you know, I just have never heard that before. Someone texted me after the screening and said, you know, I'm not a religious person, but for 10 minutes, let me tell you, I'm a true believer.
yeah.
So,
well, this gives us a chance to talk about that powerful scene in the film, that part where, so there's Jesse Jackson is taking the crowd through the experience of Dr. King's murder just the year before. And then, as you said, the great Mahalia Jackson and Mavis Staples are going to sing King's favorite song, My Precious Lord. And in this moment from the film, Mavis talks about Mahalia, as you said, handing her the microphone.
We want Sister Mahalia, Mavis Staples, And all of our groups together to prepare to do as our prayer today, precious Lord.
Precious Lord, Take My Hand was Dr. King's favorite song. And Sister Mahalia Jackson was my idol. She was my hero. I loved her so much. This day I sit right next to her, and when came time for her to sing, she leaned over and told me, "Baby, Haley don't feel too good today. I need you to help me sing this song." And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I'll help you."
Talk about that scene, will you? Because it's probably one of the most powerful moments in the film, that give and take when Mahalia does start to sing and she's up there with Mavis. And it's just, talk a little bit about this moment. It's really extraordinary.
Well, I mean, from day one, we all recognized that in some ways the movie was built around that scene, right? Because as David said, you know, it's an incredible music performance, but it was also a metaphor for so many things, right? It is gospel moving into the future with Mavis, right? And So, you know, how often are you able to have captured that moment, you know? So, it was just, you know, we knew that scene was critical to the film.
I would say, you know, in addition to that, that the gravitas of the scene, given the fact that Ben Branch, who is the leader of the orchestra that's playing the music behind that, and Reverend Jesse Jackson, you know, roughly a year before that, were with Dr. King on the balcony when he was assassinated. So the gravitas of hearing Jesse Jackson recount the story and then seeing him, you know, at I believe 20 some odd years old in front of a Harlem audience recount the story is just so powerful. And then coupled with the fact that you have these reigning queens, you know, singing a spiritual song and hearing actually the Dr. King speech on that stage during that same time, it's so powerful.
I would also say it's one of the great places in the movie where in many concert films you might just see the performance, but when you see the crowd and you see how viscerally they felt that performance, both from the somberness of it to the joy of Mavis, you're feeling it right along with them. I mean, nobody cannot understand what that would have meant the summer after it happened and hearing it told to them, you know, by a firsthand, you know, witness.
One of the attendees that you talked to in the film of the festival, Daryl Lewis, talked about how he and his friends had gone to the festival having a particular kind of style. They said, "We were suit and tie guys." But after Sly and the Family Stone, and I want to get to this scene too, because it's another, it seems like another one of the sort of pillar moments in the film. And he says, after Sly performed, they were different. He says the change was in effect.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about something like that, because we get a sense that it's not just about aesthetics or style, but, you know, styles and attitudes are changing. You had sharkskin suits in the audience, but also bell bottoms and cutoff shirts and hip huggers. And one of the things the film conveys is that it was sort of the Harlem was this, I think, as someone puts it, a melting pot for style. And that's really conveyed here in the film.
Daryl brings a great perspective. He went to this concert with a group of friends as a huge fan of the Temptations. The Temptations, as Daryl describes, you know, had all of the dance moves. They were a Motown act that wore suits and ties, and they were huge in their own right. And Daryl describes how he loved David Ruffin, who had recently broken off of the Temptations and performed at this show, but then talk
amazing performance, by the way.
I mean, David Ruffin is an amazing performance. He sings "My Girl," And it's amazing. What's equally as amazing is this is in the middle of July and David is wearing, you know, a suit, you know, with a fur collar. It must have been hot. But
his range in that performance is, I had no idea.
Yeah. I mean, guess Ruffin had such, you know, a singular voice, and, you know, in this particular performance, he not only, you know, has the falsetto that he's known for, but he holds a note for over 20 seconds. It's just amazing. But Daryl specifically, you know, talked about, you know, how he felt after seeing Sly Stone. And I think what affected him was, you know, how radically different Sly and the Family Stone were than, for instance, the Temptations. He was amazed when he first saw them in Harlem, which was a few weeks prior to Sly and the Family Stone playing at Woodstock. So when he saw them on the Harlem stage, he talked about how they would just saunter out. There was no announcement. They would tune up. Sly wasn't even there. He was frankly surprised that there were two women in the band, one that played the horn. He was surprised that the drummer was white. It was so shocking to him. But he talked about and described once they got going, they won over that audience immediately. Yeah. And the great line was, he was no longer a suit and tie guy after that performance.
Right.
I think that narrative and that performance speaks to the Black community finding its voice and realizing that we don't have to do the safe thing. We're going to play what we want. We're going to sing what we want, say what we want. I mean, you know, Sly performed, the only one to have performed at Woodstock and the Harlem Cultural Festival. You know, and that in itself is remarkable.
I would also say it was, you know, Sly was so ahead of his time in respect to, you know, he had gender a parody, you know, in his band. Not many bands did at that time. You know, not many bands were bold enough, you know, to include women and others in their particular band, and they were obviously huge and well ahead of their time.
Well, and the film explores how musicians wanted more out of their music than just, you know, popularity. I mean, they were seeing it as a time and a chance to have their music change the world. I mean, Stevie Wonder, for example, maybe you could mention this. He talks about how he had this feeling that the world was wanting a change, and he wasn't just going to play the hits. He wanted to explore music in a new way, it seems.
Well, even Gladys says in the movie that, you know, and her performance, you know, represents the, you know, the Motown sound, but even she says that their music reaching broader audiences took them around the world, and it gave them power on that level too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and Stevie was in a transitional period. He was 19 during the time he played the Harlem Cultural Festival, and, you know, had a career that started, you know, years before that, when he was called Little Stevie Wonder. You know, one of the artifacts I saw, you know, when we were digging through the ephemera was a magazine where he was pictured on the cover. And I think it said, you know, adult Stevie Wonder. So he was moving from little to an adult at the time. And he was starting to really experiment with his sound. I mean, we don't get into it necessarily in the film, but during the performance that we show, he uses a wah-wah, a pedal, which was being used by guitarists at the time. And he was capturing this, a unique sound, by using this, you know, as part of his music. And it was, you know, really cool to watch. And, you know, Stevie is such a talented musician, and it was just so great to hear him, you know, play in this particular film.
David Dinnerstein, along with Robert Fivelant, their film is Summer of Soul, or The Revolution Could Not Be Televised. It's in the Sundance Film Festival in their U.S. documentary competition. It's directed by Amir Questlove Thompson. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Like a fool, I went and stayed too. radio helps you stay informed, entertained, and connected with your community. And so does your smart speaker, because your smart speaker is also a radio. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR and stay connected at home. Never miss a minute.
Stay connected to your community with NPR Utah. Tell your smart speaker, play KUER. To learn more about listening with your smart speaker, go to KUER.org/smartspeaker.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Black Woodstock. That was the name some gave to a music festival in Harlem in the summer of 1969. It was the same year as Woodstock. The musician and historian Amir Questlove Thompson has directed a documentary about that festival, which has opened at Sundance this year. Some 40 hours of videotape from the event sat in a basement for like 50 years. And part of the story of the film is why no one wanted it. We're talking with the producers of the film, David Dinnerstein and Robert Fiveland. You'll hear Fiveland next. So this is all playing out. Now, remember, this is the summer of 1969, of course, and it's happening at the same time NASA puts a man on the moon. And, of course, the country, the world's attention was on that. But the film explores the sense of ambivalence among Black Americans about that moon landing, certainly expressed there at the Harlem Festival. Reverend Jackson says, for example, you know, you've got a country or a people more concerned about the moon than man. Talk a little bit about this part in the film.
I mean, I think that, you know, is going to be a surprise to a lot of people because, you know, we all have certain perceptions of what that meant at the time and the accomplishment of it. But the film really reveals that, you know, put in the perspective of the Harlem community, there are times that our resources aren't being appropriated properly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it was sort of amazing to us when our archivist who was working with us, Lizzie McGlynn on the film, was able to find a TV clip from CBS at the time, when you know, the news anchor, who is one of the most infamous people around, you know, broke to a reporter that was at the Harlem Festival, you know, to ask them how they felt about man landing on the moon. And to put it into context, you know, this was, you know, the Apollo 11 landed on the moon on the same day that the concert took place. And I think Walter Cronkite was imagining that reporter was going to hear a very specific narrative of support from the crowd, like most Americans. And when he cut to Bill Plant, who was the reporter at the time, you know, Bill Plant quickly realized that many people in the community, as much as they appreciated, you know, the gigantic, you know, mission, you know, were not that appreciative of the resources being used, you know, to put man on the moon, you know, compared to putting it into education, you know, medicine, businesses in the local community.
I know David commented on it a little bit, but I just want to make sure people appreciate something. You know, the finding, you know, having this footage, Hal Tolchin's footage, available for our movie was, you know, in some ways, you know, miracle number one. But I think that moment of finding Walter Cronkite going to our festival was another, you know, just incredible treasure that came out of making this movie. I mean, a lot of people may watch the movie and say, oh, they had that footage. We just happened to have found that in making the movie. I mean, nobody would even have known that Walter Cronkite thought to go ask people in Harlem what they thought, you know, and the one place they picked was this festival. So it's just an incredible find.
And just coupled with that, just in respect to the archival research and sort of the archives that are you know, included in the movie, you just have to imagine that, you know, I don't know how it works at NPR, for instance, but so much of the archives, specifically from 52 years ago, have not been digitized. So quite often people don't know what they actually have. So this was going for a treasure hunt right now to see, you know, can we find anything, you know, in and around the festival that took place during that time, you know, and that's where, you know, it led to finding Walter Cronkite. And then it led to finding people like Red Fox, who was performing, you know, at the Apollo during that time. And, you know, we just felt it captured, you know, the spirit of the a community so well.
I mean, it's a movie you can watch, you know, many times and see things you didn't see before. And if, you know, if people really pay attention to Red Fox, you can see that Sly and the Family Stone is on the bill behind him.
Right. I did notice that, by the way. Yeah.
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 It's crazy.
Let's talk about Nina Simone, finally, her performance in the festival. Remarkable, of course, as I guess you would expect. The scholar and activist Denise Oliver-Velez talks about how Nina Simone is filtering her experience in Black America through this music. Just talk a little bit about this particular moment, this performance section in the film, if you would.
Well, I mean, you know, we've talked about gospel and how gospel music played a part in what was happening at the time. And in some ways, Nina Simone represents the true passion and anger within the community. And we thought it was really important, not just to hear that in her lyrics, but even in her reading the Black Panther poem and her, you know, really trying to you know, bring that to the audience that was listening to her and you know, getting her message out. But, you know, it's really just, you know, the perfect sort of ending to the film, in a sense. Not that it's the true ending, but just to see how the musical transition led to the Black community finding its voice. And she really, you know, represents that in the strongest way possible.
Yeah, and I would just add that you know, there were three performances by Nina Simone in the film. You know, the two particular songs, one, Backlash Blues, you know, people are describing it, you know, as the equivalent of a boxing match to some extent. Yeah. I mean, it is really powerful. And, you know, then you have, you know, the first performance ever of her song Young, Gifted, and Black, which really spoke to a community and spoke about empowerment. And, you know, we have the journalist Charlene Hunter Gault describing, you know, how Nina Simone helped her in an extraordinary way when she went to the University of Georgia in the early 60s, and it just made her time there a lot easier. So, you know, I think just those two performances coupled with the poem that was obviously filled with anger, you know, was, I think, one of the most powerful performances, all three, you know, that I've ever seen. It's just incredible. And yeah, she's not only an accomplished musician, but just the way she tells her stories through song, it's singular.
I mean, yeah, to use a word that, you know, Al Sharpton uses in the film, defiance, I think it's almost impossible to find an artist that's been able to combine sort of hope with defiance, right? There is something about her music that is, you know, as with Young, Gifted, and Black, a voice of, you know, hang in there. You know, we're not gonna be denied.
Yeah, somewhere between hope and mourning, I think.
Yes.
Everyone else is. Yeah. Let me ask you finally, gentlemen. Someone says in the film, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that Black history is going to be erased. So in that context, how is Amir Thompson, how is Questlove thinking about the importance of preserving this? Is he thinking about this as history and the idea of how it is that for 50 years no one was interested in it. No one seemed to know about it.
I think that was a vital component to his mindset. You know, I think as he was looking through the 40 hours of footage, that burden of responsibility really became a lot heavier. And he realized that, you know, this is a reclamation of history. You know, how can we do it? And, you know, that particular quote was from the activist and scholar Denise Oliver of Velez, who, you know, just said that off the top of her head, that that she and others believe that, you know, African-American history is too often erased, and that, you know, now that we've been able to find, you know, a diamond in the rough, if you will, a needle in the haystack, you know, there is probably many, many, many other stories that, you know, are also in basements of people's homes and apartments around the world. And, you know, I think, you know, our hope, and I think Amir's hope, you know, is that this film will give people the opportunity to help tell those stories that we might not know about. And, you know, I think Amir, the producers, everyone involved in this film, you know, is very happy about the reception we received at the Sundance Film Festival. But most importantly, you know, we're happy that that this story is now part of history.
I know we started, you know, earlier in the conversation talking about the structure of the film. And when David and I spoke to, you know, Joseph Patel, our other producer, and Amir, about the structure of this movie, it was pretty clear that, you know, the movie was going to tell the story of how remarkable this concert was and how remarkable it was that it even happened. And then showcasing the concert itself. But there was always a beat in terms of, well, how do we end the story? And it became obvious, you know, that the end of the story was about the fact that there was no ongoing awareness of this important thing. And, you know, that really led to the idea of the film representing the erasure of Black history in a larger way. And I think it's really what makes the film as powerful as it is.
Robert Fivelant, David Dinnerstein, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's David Dinnerstein, along with Robert Fivelant. They're producers of the film Summer of Soul, or The Revolution Could Not Be Televised. It's directed by Amir Questlove Thompson, and it's in the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance this year. You can get information about the festival on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Open your heart to what I mean.